So what is causing all this cancer? You know, all the efforts that have been made. The war on cancer started in the 1970s. We're going to have a war on cancer in this country. Well, I think our war on cancer has gone about as well as our war on poverty. And I'll limit my commentary to those wars. However, it should be said that it seems like we are increasingly more aware of the things that do cause cancer. So maybe there's hope. The more we can find out about the things that are killing us, perhaps, we'll all live longer and healthier lives. But what if that thing that may be killing us is something that's also near and dear to us, like milk? I mean, we use milk as the milk of human kindness. We use mother's milk as an expression. We associate milk with all things good. Could it also be a carcinogen? And or, as Dr. Colin Campbell writes in the book, The China Study, what about animal protein in general? Could that be the biggest threat to our health? It's kind of a radical idea for a lot of people to be thinking about all the things they'd have to eliminate from their diet if Colin Campbell is right. But we'll ask him coming up next to talk about the China Study. The China Study, book subtitled Startling Implications for Diet, Weight Loss, and Long-Term Health, and what T. Colin Campbell sees as perhaps a conspiracy afoot to keep you eating the wrong stuff. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. T. Colin Campbell, The China Study, Startling Implications for Diet, Weight Loss, and Long-Term Health is out, and it's the most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted. At least that's what it says on the cover. Good evening, Dr. Campbell.
Hello.
Let me start by asking a question just to try to get a better idea about your lens, the filter that you bring to this, and the organizations to which you belong, and help us understand a little bit more about your approach to these statistics and to these particular studies that brings you to your conclusions.
Okay.
Tell us about your association with PETA or other organizations that take a sort of a very strict vegetarian or animal rights view.
I have no association with PETA and never have had.
Also,
the research that I've been doing almost for 50 years really was the research that started out from the opposite point of view. I had no intention of discovering or pushing or encouraging, a vegetarian type of diet. In fact, I thought it was all quite strange, to be honest about it.
Really?
In my career, yes.
You were eating meat and having a good steak and weren't expecting that this is how it would come out for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I was raised on a dairy farm milking cows until I went away to graduate school at Cornell University. And then there I actually did for my doctoral research a project that was intended to find more efficient ways to produce cattle, so we could eat more of them and drink more of their milk.
Right. And so what went wrong?
Well, maybe what went right, I suppose, looking back on it. But in any case, as I went through my research career, doing all different kinds of research, both in the laboratory as well as in human studies, the evidence just started accumulating and mounting in such a way that it was just an inescapable fact that we were consuming diets that were too high in animal-based foods. I mean, just exactly the opposite of what I liked, what I thought was right. And so we just had to face up to it.
What year was that?
Well, it gradually happened. I think probably during the 1960s, and especially during the 1970s, we were doing a lot of experimental animal research. Studying things in considerable detail, sort of biochemical kinds of studies and things like that.
Right.
That started to show dramatically that the feeding of something like casein, which is the main protein of cow's milk, could turn on tumor growth in animals. And we learned a great deal how that worked. And so that was sort of signal number one. And then later on in the early 80s, we had an opportunity to do this very large comprehensive study in China on people.
And let's get back to that. But before we go down that road, what was the research? How was your research received when you first brought up this idea that, look, milk is causing cancer? I mean, how were you treated by your peers? How was your research tested by other universities, as I assume it was?
Well, I didn't say, quite frankly, that milk caused cancer. These were very basic fundamental studies where we were simply using casein as a source of protein to sort of modify the cancer process as it began to emerge in these animals. I mean, I was more interested in those days in understanding how cancer really worked. And we just happened to be using casein. So I didn't really get on to the idea that, or talking very publicly, certainly, about the possibility of dairy being related to cancer until the 1990s, actually.
How'd that conversation go over with your family back on the dairy farm?
Well, my father passed away in the early 70s, so he didn't get to know too much about it. I didn't talk to him about it in that context. But the rest of the family, they listened. My mother, who still lives, she took it as a little bit of a surprise and a bit skeptical about it, I'm sure.
Right.
It just all gradually happened. And it seems that my family, that is my wife and our five grown children and now our five grandchildren, they apparently believe it all. It's pretty consistent because all of us eat the same way now.
Right. Which is a total dairy-free, animal protein-free diet?
Yes. For everyone in our family, I guess, except for occasionally a person might, we might take a little fish, but that's about it.
Okay. And so you start exploring this idea about how casein in milk might trigger or become a factor in the causation of cancer. How does that work? I mean, what is it that you see as being the early indicators that one is having an effect on the other?
Well, we started, as I said, these are very basic experimental studies.
Sure.
We could test to see how fast early cancer cells developed in these experimental animals. We could do that through histological means, taking sections of liver, for example. We could look at biochemical kinds of things. We could see how enzymes changed, enzymes that were related to the metabolism of a chemical carcinogen was given. We could look at the rates at which cells divided. We could look at sort of immune responses, these kinds of things. It was all quite biochemical. And I should point out that all of that research really was funded by public taxpayer money through the National Institutes of Health, with some money from the American Cancer Society and the American Institute for Cancer Research. So it was all public money, and it got funded. We got really generous amounts of funding through the years.
Right. That makes it easier for you. But what is it that happens to, is there, you said something is triggered or something turns on this possibility of getting cancer while having consumed milk?
Well, again, let's talk about casein at this early stage. Casein being the main protein of cow's milk, of course. As the animals are fed regular levels of so-called casein or so-called regular levels of casein, compared to much lower levels or no levels and been replaced by plant protein, the casein essentially turned on the biochemical activities that allowed, encouraged, and promoted the development of these early cancer cells. And we had ways of looking at these early cancer cells, as I said. We call them foci, for those who might be familiar with this idea. Then later we looked at you know, the effect of casein feeding upon the full lifetime development of cancer in these experimental animals. And the results were absolutely staggering. They were dramatic. We could, in fact, intervene during the development of this cancer from its very early stages, you know, on to the end stage. We could intervene with, let's say, lower levels of casein intake, or, in fact, replacing the casein entirely with plant proteins like soy protein or wheat protein, and we could turn it off.
And you could turn it off?
Yes, we could turn off these tumor cells. And so, I mean, I'm not talking about small changes. I'm talking about really big changes. And I also should say, too, that this idea didn't come out of just out of the thin air. It really came about because of my work in the Philippines during the 1960s and 1970s when I was coordinator and helping to coordinate a nationwide program of feeding malnourished children.
So you're coordinating a program for malnourished kids in the Philippines, and we would think, I mean, just looking at, you know, TV commercials about projects like that, that would be one of the first things that they would give kids who are malnourished would be to give them milk.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I had been cultured, if you will, in both personally and professionally in the early part of my career, as virtually everyone else is, that protein is a very important nutrient. And it is. I mean, we do need protein. There's no question about that. And especially we need high-quality protein, so it is said. That means animal-based protein. So when I was involved in the Philippines, one of the main things that we wanted to do there, as many of my colleagues wanted to do in countries like that, was to make sure that these kids who were so malnourished got more protein. And with assumptions always made, they didn't have enough protein. And sure enough, they didn't in many instances. But that wasn't the main thing. It turned out in the Philippines that I ran across this idea that the children who were getting the most protein, the levels that more or less we consume in this country, were coming from families that were eating like us. They were the ones that's most likely to get the cancers.
Well, how could you tell that they were the ones most likely to get the cancers? I mean, you're there to, you know, help stop starvation amongst these kids. How long were you there? How much of this could you have observed that said these families that were eating like us were the ones getting the cancers?
Well, I was working there for a period of about 10 years.
Okay.
And it just was a kind of a happenstance kind of awareness, I suppose. I was playing golf one day on the golf course with the medical advisor to the president of the Philippines, who told me, and he was a surgeon, he told me that he and his colleagues had been operating on children for liver cancer. I thought it was kind of odd. I mean, for children to get liver cancer was certainly an unusual thing, because liver cancer tends to occur in older age people. And so I just happened to be nosing around, and I had an interest in liver cancer in particular at that time. And so I just started asking around and looking at some data and came to believe that the children most likely to get the liver cancer were coming, as I said, from the families that were consuming the most protein, and particularly animal-based protein. And of course, that was exactly the opposite of what one would have expected to find in those days. And then about that time, just to confirm that observation, there was a report that came out of India among some researchers who were testing the effect of protein on the development of liver cancer in experimental animals. And they showed really unequivocally that animals given higher levels of protein, and they were using casein,
right,
that these animals were the ones that got the liver cancer after being exposed to a chemical carcinogen, compared to the animals that got much lower levels of protein. Again, it was a really dramatic difference. It wasn't a small difference. This is a huge difference between those getting, let's say, the higher levels of casein, which amounted to 20% of total calories, compared to the animals getting 5%, which was of the total calories.
Okay, but here we are then in this country, and, you know, kids are routinely, I mean, even not affluent kids get an ample amount of animal-based proteins in this cancer. Is there an epidemic of liver cancer amongst kids in America?
No, not at all. It's much lower. I mean, this, as I say, this early observation was kind of, you know, it's kind of just a question that was interesting. It was focused on a single cancer at the time. But
why would that be true of the kids in the Philippines who came from more affluent families that ate like us, but we don't get those? We don't get liver cancers if we eat meat as kids in this country.
Well, that question becomes more complicated.
Okay. Well, never mind. I don't mean to get us in too dark a hole, but I mean, it would seem like that would correlate.
Yeah, it really goes back to the question of what really causes cancer. I mean, most cancers are really oftentimes started with something that allows people to be, so to speak, predisposed to the disease. In the Philippines and other countries like that, there's a much higher prevalence of people who are exposed, for example, to a virus, hepatitis B virus, that puts them in a position of getting the liver cancer. And so it turns out that those people who are so exposed and chronically infected with that virus, when they consume higher levels of protein or animal-based foods, they're the ones most likely to get the cancer. And it is similar for other kinds of cancers, too. And so the liver, I don't want to focus too much on the liver cancer, because the liver cancer was the way that I ran across the idea. It was a narrowly focused thing. It may have, in the early days, I didn't think that really had that much relevance to anything in the West. But it was an opportunity to study at a very basic level, you know, this idea that casein, of all things, representative perhaps of other animal proteins, could actually do this. And so eventually it came around to, you know, expanding that question much, much more broadly.
And that's what brings us to the China study then.
Yes, it does.
And so here we are getting a large study group. Tell us about the circumstances that started the China study.
Well, that was in the early 1980s when our two countries first started talking to each other again. A senior scientist from China, probably one of the best-known nutritional scientists in that country, and the first one to visit the United States, came to my laboratory at Cornell University, Dr. Chen Zhengshu. He came and spent about a year with me, and he wanted to know more about cancer research. While he was with me, we learned about the fact that his government had completed a massive survey of how much cancer existed in about 2,400 counties around China. And that was featured on the sort of PBS Nova TV program at the time, and was watched by many people, shown four times, actually. This notion or this idea that cancer tended to be so common in some counties and so uncommon in other places was intriguing. And we thought, well, why not go there and organize a study to see why that's so, and organize a big study, a comprehensive study, so we could measure lots and lots of different kinds of things. And I went into the study, of course, with some interest, obviously, in testing the hypothesis that animal-based foods, obviously containing the animal protein, might be associated with these higher rates of cancer in various places. But by that time, it was a bigger question. It was more a question of animal-based foods, going even beyond the question concerning protein. So I was really interested in looking at the big picture, and looking at it in as much detail as possible.
So as you see the picture coming into focus, and we'll get into more of the specifics of what we learned about the China study, the diseases that you believe could be avoided, or perhaps the development of those diseases stopped by the cessation of consuming animal-based proteins in this country. But as you look at that, what's your conclusion about animal-based proteins? That they are they're the biggest carcinogens in our diet, or the biggest carcinogens maybe that we might be exposed to in a day?
Yes, that can go back to the animal studies just for the moment. We studied the effect of, incidentally, casein or cow's milk protein on the development of that experimental cancer development. We studied that in as much depth as any other chemical probably has ever been studied in its effect on the development of cancer. And on the basis of that information, we could conclude, using criteria, standard, well-established criteria, deciding what's a carcinogen, what's not, we could easily conclude then, and we still conclude today, that casein could be said to be the most relevant chemical carcinogen ever discovered. And so coming back to the China study then, as I say, that by that time, my views were becoming much more expansive, I should say, and it wasn't focused just on protein.
All right, well, we'll return to that thought then, coming up in just a second. Milk as a carcinogen and animal protein in general. What are the results of the China study? How else could you improve your health by changing your diet this way? Next on Coast to Coast. The most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted. 2,400 counties in China. And they were looking for cancer patterns. And as Dr. T. Colin Campbell admits to fully, he went into this with the thought that he was going to see a relationship between animal-based protein and cancer. But what he got was much more evidence than he thought he ever would, and the startling implications of what that means for diet, weight loss, and long-term health for Americans. What can we learn from the China study? We'll get into it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. It's Coast to Coast AM, and we are always on the lookout for interesting perspectives on the things which other people kind of take for granted. And this idea of giving milk to kids, as Dr. Colin Campbell was saying earlier, is pretty common, that we would think of not giving milk or meat to kids as being a kind of cruelty. That would almost be, you know, a sort of protein starving them or vitamin D starving them. But what if the opposite is true? And what if it's those things which are creating an increased rate of cancer in our country, while at the same time we spend all of this money on charities and all this money on research to try to stop cancer? And so that brings us back to the China study. And the one that was done was, did you use the same 2,400 counties that they had done earlier?
Well, we took a sample of counties.
Okay.
We couldn't do all 24, but we took a sample of 65 counties, and we had two villages in every of those 65 counties. So we actually surveyed at that time 130 villages across the country, and of course, 50 adults and their families in every village. So I mean, it gradually became much, much bigger with numbers that way. We took a sample of counties that represented the full range of mortality rates for these different diseases. And we had information on about four dozen different kinds of diseases, not just the cancers, but also other diseases like heart disease and the infectious diseases and so forth. And so,
well, go ahead, please.
At that point, I was really interested in sort of asking some very comprehensive questions.
Okay.
It's one thing to say something about protein and cancer, but we really need to know more than that.
Well, give us the headline, though, of all of the diseases that you think, what your studies indicate, are related to our consumption of milk and meat-based proteins.
Well, the Western kinds of diseases, so-called Western diseases that tend to occur in obviously Western countries or industrialized Western countries, diseases like the most of the cancers, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, many of the autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and osteoporosis. I mean, it's a vast array of diseases that collectively actually kill most of us before our time. So we're talking about a big group of diseases.
What about childhood diseases? Anything specific to that?
Yes, type 1 diabetes, which is a serious kind, is the kind that requires insulin. The children, in that case, lose their ability to produce insulin and are forever, susceptible to that diabetic condition.
Okay.
That's one. The second is, arthritic conditions, teenage acne. That's not our study. That's other studies. Can I go back and just make one comment about the discussion we've had so far on the animal data?
Sure.
One of the things that when we were doing that over that 20-year period, The purpose of those studies, it might sound a little bit esoteric to a lot of people. Why were we studying, rat cancer, so to speak?
Right.
But those kinds of studies were really the sort of the basic studies that we were doing to understand a lot of fundamental biochemical and physiological relationships, but just simply between nutrition and cancer. And I didn't, all of a sudden make some conclusion at that point that, oh, now we found the cause of liver cancer and this is a big problem in the United States. That wasn't the issue. The issue was simply learning some fundamental principles of how nutrition related to cancer. And that was at a very exciting time because it allowed us to develop some principles of that might apply to other cancers, might apply to other diseases, might apply to other nutrients.
Sure.
That's really what it was all about.
Okay. And so, and that was then confirmed then by the China study.
Yes, exactly. And not just the China study. Again, it was confirmed as we began to, collect information in the China study, but in particular also looking at the emergence of lots of other studies coming from other laboratories.
Okay, but what did we learn? What do we know now after the China study that we didn't know before?
Well, first off, and this is my interpretation of the evidence, that even relatively small intakes of animal-based foods,
like
mischievous and can cause serious problems for a lot of people.
Like a hamburger a week, kind of small,
Yes.
Really?
That's right. It's not a question of maybe a hamburger a week, causing problems that we can actually measure. That's not the issue because we couldn't, for the most part, tell anyhow. But it's the idea that when we do that, we tend to decrease the consumption of whole plant-based foods like vegetables and fruits and whole grains and legumes. And when we get away from that good food, by doing that, that's where also a major part of this issue arises, because it's the lack of consumption of those good plant-based foods that also relate to this question, too. And just to take a hamburger a week, people often ask me, do I have to go the whole way in order to get this benefit? Well, if a person goes most of the way, they can get some benefit. There's good evidence for that. But the problem with kind of sneaking in a little bit now and again, it keeps teasing us to go back to consuming the foods we ought not to consume.
But that's a behavioral issue, not so much a biochemical issue.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's sort of like the tobacco thing is a good question and point. Somebody, if you've got a heavy smoker, it's not quite fair to tell him that it's okay to have, you can have a few cigarettes a week or something like that. Because, they never really lose the habit by doing that.
Well, but if they had, if they went from being a pack-a-day smoker to having the occasional cigarette, and they were able to stay on that for the rest of their life, you can't say in that sense that if you're in for a dime, you're in for a dollar. You're still better off having the occasional celebratory cigarette or however one looks at that.
That's true. But okay.
Well, people do. I know people who were alcoholics, who were, treatable alcoholics, who sometime later in their life, after many years of treatment and other things, were able to go to a occasional glass of wine consumption level and were able to get by on that. I'm not recommending that. I'm not saying that everybody should, but just for them, that was the right thing to do. And that behavior didn't, in the end, necessitate becoming an alcoholic again. They just were finally able to have control over it.
True. I agree with that. Yeah, sure.
All right. So, but that's a behavioral thing. But from a biochemical standpoint, if you had one hamburger a week and the rest of the week you ate a plant, legume-based raw food or however you look at lots of vegetable diet, you would get the benefits of this diet change.
Yes, but most people would. They get probably a good part of that benefit, except for some people who are especially vulnerable. If people already have evidence of, let's say, heart disease, for example, or evidence of cancer, you wouldn't want those people to even get close to those kinds of foods, quite frankly, because even small intakes in that particular case have been shown to, perhaps even play havoc and put their lives at risk.
Okay. So what we know now after the China study is that if you give up on all animal-based proteins, if you had an animal-based protein-free diet, what would happen?
Well, they would reduce their risk, substantially reduce their risk for the diseases we just mentioned, the different kinds of cancers, heart disease, diabetes, control their weight in a healthy way for long term. To say that we're going to get rid of all those diseases, that's not a reasonable conclusion. But we could reduce it by, in my view, according to what data we now have, we could reduce those diseases by 80 to 90% at least.
That's tantamount to getting rid of it.
Yes, it is. And if you just reduce it by 10%, you can imagine what effect that has on medical care costs, for example.
Right. Well, but then let's go through some of the other ones. I've heard about this in reference to multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. And the animal or the diet is very relevant to people who have MS.
Yes.
Was that also part of your survey?
Wasn't part of my survey or our survey, but it now is coming up that, you know, in other kinds of research from elsewhere, some of this has been around, quite frankly, for 40 to 50 years. There's some really elegant studies that have been conducted pretty much out of view of the public and, unfortunately, out of the view of the professionals even,
okay,
showing that diet really has a major effect on multiple sclerosis or the progression of multiple sclerosis. And that's a really sad story because there's some very good research that goes back, you know, 40 to 50 years showing that diet can be used. And the same kind of diet, incidentally, plant-based diet, can actually be used to prevent the progression of multiple sclerosis. It's really an insidious, difficult disease. It can be used to prevent the progression of that disease. But yet, if you look on the professional, in the professional literature or professional society literature for multiple sclerosis or on the websites to see what they have to say about diet, they just completely ignore it.
I knew somebody who had MS, and they were very careful about their diet, and they talked about how when they weren't, they could tell immediately how it was affecting their MS. All right, but then let's say somebody I know has the first diagnosis of cancer, right? And let's say lymphoma.
Right.
What could change in that diagnosis or in that prognosis? What could change by immediately switching to an animal-based protein-free diet?
Well, part of this is based on theory, you know, based on experimental results so far. But it just simply turns out that, and this comes back to the experimental animal data, that we could, just that concept of keeping under control and even reversing the disease process, you know, by through nutritional means was a very exciting concept. And in the case of lymphoma that you just mentioned, I don't know in this particular case of studies on lymphoma what effect it would have, but it turns out that of all the cancers that I know of for which there have been studies, nutrition does play a role in the same fashion as we learned in this experimental cancer.
Well, what are we talking about adding in terms of time or delaying the effects or, I mean, any kind of measurable difference it would make?
Yes. What one can argue is this, and this is a lot of evidence for this. If you could delay a cancer, let's say the occurrence of that cancer for, let's say, just for the heck of it, 50, 60, 70 years instead of, you know, what might occur in the next 4 or 5 years. In other words, delay the cancer occurrence until sometime after our lifetime. Well, there's your answer. You never see the cancer again. The cancer may progress very slowly in some people, even when they're more or less doing things right. But if the end result is not going to come until we're about 120, 150 years of age, we've essentially eliminated it.
A lot of people, eat tofu. My kids eat tofu. I eat tofu. I actually stopped eating meat by and large about a year ago. I have recently, I would say within the last couple of weeks, had a couple of servings of turkey. And I had one other serving of beef. And I was sort of doing it just to see whether I missed it terribly or whether I could go on without it. And I spent, I don't know, a better part of a year being a vegetarian, although I eat lots of fish. What do you think is going on for me? I mean, what kind of health benefits would a guy like me, 45, doesn't exercise as much as he would like, but what kind of reduction in cancer am I seeing because of what I'm doing?
Well, we're talking about reduction of risk for cancer,
right,
the odds of getting cancer, if you will. I think you're doing really quite well compared to the average person. Let's say your risk is reduced by half. It's kind of a conjecture, maybe 7, maybe 3/4. That's a lot.
Okay.
And
that's worth it.
Yeah, but, you know, the cancer occurrence, of course, is specific for every individual. So every individual either gets the disease or doesn't get the disease, essentially.
But I drink a lot of milk. So well,
that's a problem.
That's the problem. If I drink milk, if I have a serving or two a day of skim milk, am I mitigating the loss of meat in my diet?
No. Milk, and especially skim milk, to be honest about it, is now being associated in different studies, as our early data would have predicted, is being associated with the increasing risk of some of the very serious cancers, like prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, and some other cancers.
Well,
I mean,
why?
Milk is nothing more than liquid meat, some people say.
Okay, well, why? Why would skim milk be more of a problem than whole milk?
Well, skim milk has no fat, essentially. And so it is mostly made up of, as far as macronutrients are concerned, it's made up of protein. In fact, the concentration of protein in skim milk is higher
right.
than it is in whole milk.
Why is that bad?
So go from whole milk to skim milk, you actually increase the concentration of protein as a percent of total calories, that is.
Okay.
And so you've got a really good, I want to say healthy protein drink, but it's not a healthy protein drink. You've got a rich protein drink that you're taking. And so skim milk has no gain compared to whole milk. And that's been rather much of a unfortunate misrepresentation over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
But if I'm drinking skim milk, I might as well be having beef. As far as my body's concerned, I'm really not living meat free.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Milk of any kind, you know, whether it's 1%, 2% whole milk, skim milk, basically is a problem.
Okay. All right. And what other things have we learned from the China study? What else came out of that either, you know, from an academic viewpoint or from your peers makes it a startling study with startling implications?
Well, a whole lot of sort of more specific kinds of observations that are sort of bear on this general impression. In China, for example, we discovered that they could actually consume more calories and have less obesity, which is, quite frankly, a startling observation, I think. It's not, you know, just counting calories is a very simplistic way of understanding the relationship between diet and obesity, but consume more calories and less body weight. And much of that was due to the fact that the Chinese, of course, were more physically active. But the interesting thing about this is that we were comparing Westerners, let's say in this case, with Chinese who were the least active, the ones who were classified as office worker type people. And even those people consumed more calories. They were consuming more calories because they were more physically active in part and gaining the benefits thereof. But also, they were consuming these low-fat, plant-based diets, and that also plays a role because people consuming that kind of food can afford to consume a little more calories and not gain body weight because the calories being consumed are being expended as body heat or maybe encouraging a little more physical activity. And we looked at that question in great depth, both in the laboratory and compared with other information. That was an exciting proposition. There was a whole lot of these kinds of examples from the China study that when we started comparing our results, one kind of result with another, we could begin to explain some of the complexities, you know, of various and sundry kinds of diseases.
Okay. And you mentioned many of these diseases affecting women, and I guess in a way I'm surprised that's not getting more of a headline because a lot of women say that they really need a lot of meat protein, that women crave meat protein, whether it's because of their cycle or whatever, that they really do crave it. And yet, that would, if that's true, that there's a direct link, then uterine and breast and ovarian cancers are directly linked to that. That's a big story.
It is a big story. And of course, as you may know, those cancers are much more common here than they are elsewhere. They're much more common in countries where we consume more animal-based foods, including dairy.
Well,
so it's an important story.
The important findings from the most comprehensive large study ever undertaken, the China study, startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health. We'll talk about it with one of the authors of the book, The China Study, T. Colin Campbell, Dr. Campbell, next. And we'll start taking your calls next hour. And we'll talk about some of the other autoimmune diseases affected by this on Coast to Coast AM.